Leviathan, Part 1, Man, by Thomas Hobbes, first published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Introduction and Chapters 1 through 3. Introduction. Nature is the art through which God made the world and still governs it. The art of man imitates it in many ways, one of which is its ability to make an artificial animal. Life is just a motion of limbs caused by some principal part inside the body. So why can't we say that all automata, engines that move themselves by springs and wheels as a watch does, have an artificial life? For what is the heart but a spring? What are the nerves but so many strings? What are the joints but so many wheels enabling the whole body to move in the way its designer intended? Art goes still further, imitating that rational and most excellent work of nature, man. For by art is created that great Leviathan called a commonwealth, or state, which is just an artificial man, though bigger and stronger than the natural man, for whose protection and defence it was intended. Here are some details of the analogy between a commonwealth and a natural man. The chief authority in the commonwealth is an artificial soul, giving life and motion to the whole body as the soul does to the body of a natural man. The magistrates and other officers of the law are artificial joints. Reward and punishment are artificial nerves. They are connected to the seat of the chief authority in such a way that every joint and limb is moved to do his duty, as natural nerves do in the body of a natural man. The wealth and riches of all the members of the commonwealth are its strength. The people's safety is the commonwealth's business. Advisers who suggest to it everything it needs to know are its memory. Justice is its artificial reason. Laws are its artificial will. Civil harmony is its health. Sedition is its sickness, and civil war is its death. Lastly, the pacts and agreements by which the parts of this body politic were at first made, put together, and united, resemble that fiat, that "let us make man," pronounced by God when he was creating the world. To describe the nature of this artificial man, I will consider, in Part 1, what the commonwealth is made of, men, and who made it, men. In Part 2, how and through what agreements the commonwealth is made. What are the rights and legitimate power or authority of a sovereign? And what can preserve a commonwealth, and what can dissolve it? In Part 3, what is a Christian commonwealth? In Part 4, what is the kingdom of darkness? Concerning the first topic, there is a saying that has recently become fashionable, that wisdom is acquired not by reading books, but by reading men. On the basis of this, people who show few other signs of wisdom take pleasure in showing what they think they have read in men by saying nasty things about them behind their backs. But there is another saying, not properly understood in recent times, through which men might learn truly to read one another, if they would take the trouble. The saying is nosce te ipsum, Latin for know yourself, read yourself. This has come to be used to excuse the barbarous conduct of men in power towards their inferiors, or to encourage men of low degree in disrespectful behaviour towards their betters. But that's not what it was meant for. It was meant to teach us that if you are interested in how the thoughts and passions of one man resemble those of another, you should look into yourself, and consider what you do when you think, believe, reason, hope, fear, etc., and on what grounds you do so. That will enable you to read and know what the thoughts and passions of all other men are on similar occasions. I am speaking of the similarity of passions, which are the same in all men, desire, fear, hope, etc., not the similarity of the objects of the passions, which are the things desired, feared, hoped, etc. There is less similarity among the latter, because what a person wants, fears, etc., depends on his individual character and upbringing. The objects of someone's passions are also harder to know about, because they are easy for him to hide, so much so that the writing in a man's heart, to continue with the reading metaphor, so blotted and mixed up by dissembling, lying, faking, and false beliefs, can be read only by someone who can search hearts. We sometimes learn from men's actions what they are up to, but to do this without comparing those actions with our own, and noting all the relevant differences, is to decipher without a key, and to be for the most part deceived, by too much trust or too much distrust, depending on whether the reader is himself a good man or a bad one. Anyway, however skilled someone is at reading others by their actions, that can serve him only with the few people he knows personally. Someone who is to govern a whole nation must read in himself not this or that particular man, but mankind. This is hard to do, harder than learning any language or science. But when I have set before you, in an orderly and clear manner, my own reading of myself, you will be left only with the task of considering whether it also applies to you. There is no other way to prove a doctrine of this kind. Chapter 1. Sense. Concerning the thoughts of man, I will consider them first taken one at a time, and then taken in a sequence, with one thought depending on another. Each single thought is a representation or appearance of some quality or feature of a body outside us, what we call an object. Such objects work on the eyes, ears, and other parts of a man's body, and by working in different ways they produce different appearances. The source of all those appearances is what we call sense, for there is no conception in a man's mind that wasn't first, either as a whole or in parts, produced through the organs of sense. For present purposes it isn't necessary to know what the natural cause of sense is, and I have written about that at length elsewhere. Still, to make my presentation complete, I will briefly discuss it here. The cause of sense is the external body or object which presses the organ proper to each sense, either immediately, as in taste and touch, or through an intermediary, as in seeing, hearing, and smelling. This pressure is passed inwards along the nerves and other strings and membranes of the body to the brain and heart. There it causes a resistance, or counter-pressure, or endeavour, by the heart to deliver itself, to disburden itself, to speak what is on its mind. Because this endeavour, or counter-pressure, is outward, it seems to be some matter outside the body, and this seeming or fancy, this mental representation or image, is what we call sense. For the eye it consists in shaped light or colour, for the ear in a sound, for the nostril in an odour, for the tongue and palate in a taste, and for the rest of the body in heat, cold, hardness, softness, and such other qualities as we detect through touch. All these sensible qualities are, in the object that causes them, merely different motions of the matter by which the object presses on our organs. In us, too, the ones who are pressed, the qualities are merely various motions, for they are caused by motions, and motion produces nothing but motion. But to us, their appearance is fancy, the same waking as dreaming. And as pressing, rubbing, or striking the eye makes us fancy a light, and pressing the ear produces a fancied noise, so also in ordinary seeing and hearing we are acted on by external bodies, though we don't observe their action. Those colours and sounds are in us. For if they were in the bodies or objects that cause them, they couldn't be separated from them. We know they can be separated from them, because through the use of a mirror the appearance can be in one place and the object in another. And echoes provide something similar for sounds. And though, at the right distance and in the right circumstances, the actual object seems to be clothed with the fancy that it causes in us, still the object is one thing, the image or fancy is another. So that in all cases, sense is nothing but fancy that is caused by the pressure, that is, by the motion, of external things on our eyes, ears, and other organs with that function. But the philosophy schools, through all the universities of the Christian world, on the basis of certain texts of Aristotle's, teach a different doctrine, using the technical term visible species, which, to put it in plain English, is a visible show, apparition, or aspect, or being seen. They explain vision by saying that the thing that is seen sends out in all directions a visible species, and that seeing the object is receiving this visible species into the eye. And for the cause of hearing, they say that the thing that is heard sends forth an audible species, that is, an audible aspect or audible being seen, which enters the ear and creates hearing. Indeed, for the cause of understanding, they say that the thing that is understood sends out intelligible species, that is, an intelligible being seen, which comes into the understanding and makes us understand. I don't say this in criticism of universities. I shall come later to the topic of their role in a commonwealth. But before I get to that, I must take every opportunity to let you see what things would be amended in them if they played their proper role properly, and one of these is the frequency of meaningless speech. Chapter 2. Imagination. Nobody doubts this. When a thing lies still, it will lie still forever unless something else moves it. But this, when a thing is in motion, it will eternally be in motion unless something else stops it, is not so easily assented to, although there is the same reason for it, namely that nothing can change itself. That is because men measure not only other men, but all other things by themselves. Finding themselves liable to be sore and tired after moving, they think that everything else grows weary of motion, and of its own accord seeks rest. They don't consider the possibility that the desire for rest that they find in themselves consists of some other motion. And so we find the schools, the universities whose philosophy teaching is heavily influenced by Aristotle, saying that heavy bodies fall downwards out of an appetite or desire for rest, and so as to conserve themselves in the place that is most proper for them, absurdly ascribing to inanimate things both appetite for self-preservation and, something that even men don't have, knowledge of how to go about securing it. When a body is once in motion, it moves for ever unless something else stops it, and whatever stops it does so gradually over a period of time. It can't extinguish the motion in an instant. When wind creates waves in the sea, the waves keep rolling for a long time after the wind stops, and the same thing happens with the motion that is made in the internal parts of a man when he sees, dreams, etc. For after the object is removed, or the eyes closed, we still retain an image of the thing we have seen, though more obscure than when we saw it. This is what the Latins call imagination, from the image made in seeing, and they improperly apply the term to all other senses as well. But the Greeks call it fancy, which means appearance, and is equally proper for all the senses. So imagination is nothing but decaying sense. It is found in men, and many other living creatures, and occurs when they are sleeping as well as when they are awake. The decay of sense in a person who is awake is not the dying down of the motion made in sense. Rather, it is an obscuring of that motion, in the way the light of the sun obscures the light of the stars. Stars exercise their power to make themselves visible in daytime, just as much as at night. But among the many strokes that our eyes, ears, and other organs receive from external bodies, only the predominant one is sensed. So when the light of the sun is predominant, we aren't affected by the action of the stars. And when an object is removed from our sight, the impression it made in us continues. But as it is followed by other objects that are more present to us, and that work on us, the imagination of the past object is obscured and weakened, as the voice of a man is drowned by the noise from the street. From this it follows that the longer the time is since the sight or other sensing of any object, the weaker is the imagination of it. For the continual changes in a man's body eventually destroy the parts that were moved in sensing, and that is why distance in time has the same effect on us as distance in space. Just as at a great spatial distance, the thing we look at appears dim and fuzzy in its details, so also after great distance of time our imagination of the past is weak, and we lose, for example, particular streets of cities we have seen, and particular details of events we have experienced. We have two ways of talking about this decaying sense. When we want to talk about the thing itself, the fancy itself, we call it imagination, as I said before. But when we want to talk about the decay, and signify that the sense is fading, old and past, we call it memory. So imagination and memory are a single thing with different names for different purposes. Much memory, or memory of many things, is called experience. Imagination is always of things that have been formerly perceived by sense, either all at once or by parts at different times. In the former case, imagining the whole object as it was presented to the senses, we have simple imagination, as when you imagine a man or horse that you have seen before. The other is compounded imagination, as when from the sight of a man at one time and of a horse at another, you conceive in your mind a centaur. So when a man compounds the image of his own person with the image of the actions of someone else, as when a man imagines himself a Hercules or an Alexander, which happens often with devoted readers of romances, it is a compound imagination, and strictly speaking, just a fiction of the mind. There are other imaginations that arise in men, while awake, as a result of especially strong impressions made on them in sensing. For example, gazing for a long time at the sun creates an image of the sun that stays before our eyes for a long time afterwards. And from a long and fiercely focused attention on geometrical figures, a waking man in the dark may have the images of lines and angles before his eyes. This kind of fancy has no particular name, because it is not something we talk about much. The imaginations that people have while asleep are what we call dreams. A dream, like all other imaginations, has previously been in the senses, either altogether as a whole or in bits. The brain and nerves, which are the necessary organs of sense, are so benumbed in sleep that they can't easily be moved by the action of external objects, and therefore in sleep no imagination, and therefore no dream, can occur except as a result of the agitation of the inner parts of the person's body. And even when these inner parts are out of order, their connection with the brain and other organs enables them to keep these in motion. In this way, the imaginations formerly made inside the man appear as if he were awake, except for this. The organs of sense are now in sleep, benumbed, so that no new object can dominate and obscure the imaginations with a more vigorous impression. And so in this silence of sense, a dream must be clearer than our waking thoughts. That is why it is difficult, something impossible, to distinguish exactly between sense and dreaming. For my part, when I consider that in dreams I don't often or constantly think of the same persons, places, objects, and actions that I do waking, and that I don't remember as long a sequence of coherent thoughts in dreams as at other times, and that when I am awake, I often note the absurdity of dreams, but never dream of the absurdities of my waking thoughts, I am well satisfied that when I am awake, I know that I am not dreaming, even though when I dream, I think I am awake. And because dreams are caused by the disorder of some of the inner parts of the body, different disorders are bound to cause different dreams. For being cold in one sleep breeds dreams of fear, and raises the thought and image of some fearful object, because the motion from the brain to the inner parts is matched by an opposite motion from the inner parts to the brain. Another example. Just as anger causes heat in some parts of the body when we are awake, so when we sleep, the overheating of the same parts causes anger, and raises up in the brain the imagination of an enemy. A third example, just as natural kindness when we are awake causes desire, which creates heat in certain other parts of the body, so also too much heat in those parts while we are asleep raises in the brain an imagination of some kindness shown. In short, our dreams are the reverse of our waking imaginations. The motion when we are awake starts at one end, and when we dream, it starts at the other. It is hardest for a man to distinguish a dream from his waking thoughts when for some reason he doesn't realize he has been asleep. This can easily happen to someone who is full of fearful thoughts and has a conscience that is much troubled, and to someone who sleeps without the performance of undressing and going to bed, having nodded off in his armchair. Someone who does go through the performance isn't likely to think that any weirdly unfamiliar fancy that comes to him is anything but a dream. We read of Marcus Brutus, who owed his life to Julius Caesar and was his favourite, yet murdered him, how at Philippi, the night before he gave battle to Augustus Caesar, he saw a fearful apparition. Historians usually call it a vision, but considering the circumstances, one may easily judge it to have been merely a short dream. For sitting in his tent, brooding and troubled with the horror of his rash act, it was not hard for Brutus, slumbering in the cold, to dream of what frightened him most, and as this fear gradually woke him up, it must also have made the apparition gradually vanish. And not knowing for sure that he had been asleep, he could have no reason to think it a dream or anything but a vision. And this is not a rare occurrence, for even people who are wide awake, if they are nervous and superstitious and full of scary stories and alone in the dark, are apt to have such fancies, and to believe they see spirits and dead men's ghosts walking in churchyards. This ignorance of how to distinguish dreams and other strong fancies from seeing and sensing is the chief source of the religion of the pagans of past centuries, who worshipped satyrs, fauns, nymphs, and the like, and the source of the belief that uneducated people have now in fairies, ghosts, and goblins, and in the power of witches. I include witches in that list because I don't think that their witchcraft is any real power. Still, I think they are justly punished for their false belief that they can do such mischief, together with their intention of doing harm if they can, so that their trade is nearer to being a new religion and to being a craft or science. As for fairies and walking ghosts, I think the belief in them has deliberately been taught, or not challenged, so as to keep people believing in the use of exorcism, of crosses, of holy water, and other such inventions of ghostly men, which is what I call priests. No doubt God can make unnatural apparitions, but it is not an article of the Christian faith that he does this so often that men should fear such things, more than they fear a stoppage of the course of nature, or a change in it, either of which God can also bring about. But claims about the frequency of divinely sent apparitions are still made, because evil men, under pretext that God can do anything, are impudently willing to say whatever suits their purpose, even if they think it untrue. A wise man will believe them only to the extent that right reason makes what they say seem credible. Men would be much more fitted than they are for civil obedience if this superstitious fear of spirits were got rid of, and with it, future reading based on dreams, false prophecies, and many other effects of such superstition by which crafty, ambitious men abuse simple people. This cleansing operation ought to be the work of the schools, but instead of doing it, they encourage such doctrines, because the schoolmen, the Aristotelian philosophy teachers, don't know what imagination or the senses are. They have no defences against error in these matters, and so they teach what they have been taught. Some say that imaginations arise spontaneously and have no cause. Others, that they usually arise from the will, and that good thoughts are blown, inspired, into a man by God, and evil thoughts blown in by the devil, or that good thoughts are poured, infused, into a man by God, and evil ones poured in by the devil. Some say that the senses receive the species of things, and pass them on to the common sense, thence to the imagination, to the memory, to the judgment, like passing things from hand to hand, with many words making nothing understood. The imagination raised in man, or any other creature capable of imagining, by words, or other voluntary signs, is what we generally call understanding. It is common to man and beast, for a dog will through custom come to understand the call, or the scolding of his master, and so will many other beasts. That, however, involves only understanding what his master wants. The understanding that is special to man, and not shared with the beasts, is the understanding not only of what others want, but also of what they think and believe. And this understanding is based on how sequences of names of things are woven together into affirmations, negations, and other forms of speech. I shall discuss this kind of understanding later. Chapter 3. The Consequence or Train of Imaginations. By consequence of thoughts, or train of thoughts, I mean the occurrence of thoughts, one at a time, in a sequence. We call this mental discourse, to distinguish it from discourse in words. When a man thinks about something, what his next thought will be is not quite as accidental a matter as it seems to be. It isn't the case that any thought is as likely as any other to follow a given thought. On the contrary, just as we never have an imagination that hasn't previously been presented to us, as a whole or in parts, by our senses, so we never have a transition from one imagination to another that is unlike any transition we have had in our senses. Here is why. All fancies are motions inside us, leftovers from the motions made in sensing. And when one motion is immediately followed by another in sensing, that sequence of motions also continues after the sensing is over, because when the former motion again occurs and predominates, the latter motion follows. A familiar example of the same phenomenon. When water is pooled on a flat surface, and you draw some of it in one direction with your finger, the rest of the water follows. However, a thing perceived by the senses will be followed sometimes by one thing and sometimes by another, so that in due course they come to be rival candidates for the role of follower of a given imagination. Thus, when someone imagines something, there is no certainty about what he will imagine next, but it is certain that it will be something that followed the other at some earlier time. This train of thoughts or mental discourse is of two sorts. The first is unguided, unplanned, and inconstant. In this, the sequence of thoughts is not governed by any passionate thought, which could direct the whole sequence towards some chosen end, and the thoughts are said to wander, and seem irrelevant to one another, as in a dream. Men often have thoughts like this when they are alone, and not absorbed in any cares. Their thoughts are still as busy as at other times, but there is no harmony to them, like the sound of an untuned lute, or of a tuned one played by an incompetent. Yet in this untamed roaming of the mind, we can still often see what is going on, and grasp how one thought depends on another. For in a discussion about England's present civil war, what could seem more irrelevant than to ask, as someone did, what was the value of a Roman penny? But I saw its relevance plainly enough. The thought of the war introduced the thought of the delivering up of the king to his enemies, which brought in the thought of the delivering up of Christ, which led to the thought of the 30 pennies or 30 pieces of silver, which was the price of that betrayal. And from that, the malicious question about the value of a Roman penny easily followed. All this happened in a moment of time, for thought is quick. The second sort of train of thoughts is more constant, being regulated by some desire and some design. The impression made by things that we desire or fear is strong and permanent, or if it stops for a time, it comes back quickly. It is sometimes so strong that it keeps us awake at night, or interrupts our sleep. A desire generates the thought of some means we have seen producing something like what we desire. And from that comes a thought of means to those means, and so on, continually, until we come to some beginning that is within our own power. What we are aiming at, our end, makes a strong impression, and so comes often to mind, so that if our thoughts begin to wander, they are quickly brought back into line by this strong and frequently present impression of the end. It was his knowledge of this that led one of the seven wise men to give his followers the injunction, now a cliché, respice finem, Latin for look to the end, meaning, in all your actions, keep an eye on what you are aiming at, letting your view of that direct all your thoughts about how to achieve it. The train of regulated thoughts is itself of two kinds. In one, we imagine an effect, and look for the causes or means that would produce it. And this is common to man and beast. It is the kind of thinking I focused on in the preceding paragraph. The other occurs when we imagine something, anything, and look for all the possible effects that could be produced by it. That is, we imagine what we can do with it when we have it. I have never seen any sign of this except in man, for this kind of curiosity, asking, "What can I do with it?" has little grip on a living creature with no passions except sensual ones, such as hunger, thirst, lust, and anger. In sum, the discourse of the mind, when it is controlled by some aim or plan, is nothing but seeking or the faculty of discovery. It is a hunting out of the causes of some present or past effect, or of the effects of some present or past cause. Sometimes a man seeks something he has lost, and from the place and time where he missed it, his mind runs back from place to place and time to time to find where and when he had it. That is to say, to find some definite limited time and place in which to start searching. Again, from there, his thoughts run over the same places and times to find what action or other occasion might have made him lose it. We call this remembrance, or calling to mind. Sometimes a man knows a definite place within which he has to search, and then his thoughts run over all the parts of it, in the way one would sweep a room to find a jewel, or as a spaniel runs all over a field till he picks up a scent, or as a man might run through the alphabet to make a rhyme. Sometimes a man wants to know the outcome of an action, and then he thinks back to some earlier action of the same kind, and the sequence of its outcomes, supposing similar outcomes will follow similar actions. For example, someone may foresee what will become of a criminal by running over what he has seen follow from a similar crime before. Having these thoughts in this order, the crime, the arresting officer, the prison, the judge, and the gallows. Thoughts of this kind are called foresight and prudence or providence, and sometimes wisdom, though this kind of guesswork is very fallacious, because of the difficulty of taking into account all the relevant circumstances. Still, this much is certain. If one man has more experience of things past than does another, he will be correspondingly more prudent than the other, and less often wrong in his expectations. Only the present has an existence in nature. Things past exist in the memory only, and future things don't exist at all, because the future is just a fiction, a creation of the mind, arrived at by noting the consequences that have ensued from past actions, and assuming that similar present actions will have similar consequences, an assumption that pushes us forward into the supposed future. This kind of extrapolation is done the most securely by the person who has the most experience, but even then not with complete security. And though it is called prudence, when the outcome is as we expected, it is in its own nature a mere presumption. For the ability to see in advance things that are to come belongs only to God, through whose will they are to come about. He alone can prophesy, and he does it supernaturally. The person who does the best job of prophesying naturally is the best guesser, and the best guesser is the one who knows most about the matters he guesses at, and has studied them most thoroughly, for he has the most signs to guess by. A sign is the evident antecedent of the consequent, and in the other direction, the consequent of the antecedent. For example, dark clouds may be a sign that rain is to come. A burning tree may be a sign that lightning has struck. This requires that similar consequences have been observed before, and the oftener they have been observed, the less uncertain is the sign. So the man with most experience in any kind of business has the most signs by which to guess what the future holds, and consequently is the most prudent. And this advantage in prudence is not counterbalanced by any advantage a less experienced person may have in natural cleverness and quick-wittedness, though many young men might disagree with this. Nevertheless, prudence is not what distinguishes man from the beast. Some beasts, when 1 year old, observe more and more prudently pursue their goals than a human child can do at age 10. As prudence is a presumption about the future, condensed from experience of the past, so also there is a presumption about past things on the basis of other past things. Someone who has seen how and how drastically a flourishing state has come first into civil war and then to ruin, when he sees the similarly ruined condition of any other state, will guess that the latter has had a similar war brought about in a similar way. But this kind of conjecture is nearly as uncertain as conjectures about the future, both being based only on experience. This is the only kind of mental act I can think of that is naturally planted in man, so that all he needs in order to be able to perform it is to be born a human and to live with the use of his 5 senses. The other faculties that I shall discuss later, ones that seem to be possessed by men and not by the beasts, are acquired and improved by study and hard work. Most men get them through instruction and discipline, and they all come from the invention of words and speech. For all the human mind's motions, except those of sense, thoughts, and sequences of thoughts, come through the help of speech and method, faculties that can be improved to an extent that marks men off from all other living creatures. Whatever we imagine is finite. Therefore, there is no idea or conception of anything we call infinite. No man can have in his mind an image of infinite size, or conceive infinite speed, infinite time, infinite force, or infinite power. When we say something is infinite, we signify only that we can't conceive its ends or boundaries, having no conception of infinity except that of our own inability. And therefore God is called infinite, not to make us conceive him, for he is incomprehensible, and his greatness and power can't be conceived, but to bring us to honour him. Also, as I said before, anything we conceive, we have first perceived by sense, either all at once or in parts. A man can't have a thought representing something that couldn't be sensorially perceived. So anything a man can conceive must be conceived as being in some place, and having a definite size, and divisible into parts. And he can't conceive that something can be all in this place and all in that, or that 2 or more things can be in 1 and the same place at once. None of these things has, none of them could, ever be presented through the senses. They are merely absurd ways of talking, credulously taken over, in all their meaninglessness, from deceived scientists and deceived, or deceiving, schoolmen. End of chapter 3.